Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 2, delivered on January 14, 2010. The title of this lecture is Financial Institutions and Markets.
Today, Financial Institutions and Markets. This is approximately half of Chapter 2. I shall cabin this lecture to cover only the institutions and markets and leave for Tuesday's lecture interest rates. Although I am going to have to do a little bit of spillage, I have to do a little bit here in this lecture on interest rates, but I'll avoid the major impact for the next lecture on the interest rates themselves. And there will be an assigned reading. I believe I will have an assigned reading on my website for you having to do with the Federal Reserve, or an assigned video of some kind just to refresh your knowledge of the Federal Reserve. Now, I assume that you have had an economics course, although I know that for most of you, you didn't have it from me, so you didn't have it as good as it can get. So I will have to put in some economics, some macroeconomics concepts, and I'll do that on Tuesday as well for the most part. This is in part a terminology lecture, but there is also conceptual background here. In this course, you're going to see that sometimes it's just numbers. Do the formulas, follow the rules, and get the numerical answers. But there is also a lot in this course that is based upon terminology, understanding the terminology, and being able to apply the concepts behind that terminology. And today you're going to hear a lot about terms and words and phrases and what they mean to us. Now, I caution you that you've probably used some of these terms before, but you haven't used them the way we use them in finance and in business more generally. So I begin with a simple statement. Oh, for God's sake, turn that damn thing off. Oh, I should talk. Wait a minute. Let me make sure mine is off, too. I bitch about it, then I realize, oh, mine is on, too. Okay. You got any money in your pocket?
No, sir.
Okay, you see, there you go. It doesn't mean you're a loser, but at the same time, if you needed some money right now, you don't have any. So you'd have to borrow some from someone else. You are an economic deficit unit. Now, that doesn't mean you're a deficit person, although maybe you are, I don't know you. But you're an economic deficit unit. You're a part of the economy that is in need of money. You got any money? What is it with you people? Money, okay? What the hell, man, you know? Okay, fine, I got some money.
Do I have
Oh, yeah. Whoa, $5, yeah, okay. I'm a surplus economic unit. If you really needed money for something right now, the woman beside you says, if you don't give me $5, I'm going to kill you. You might, you know, say, you know, I really kind of like would like to have $5 right now. I need $5, and I could provide that with you. You see, I'm a surplus unit, economic unit right now. I have a surplus. And in our lives, oftentimes we will move between being deficit units and surplus units. Businesses are the same way. Individuals, institutions, there are times when you need money you don't have, and there are times when you have money that you don't need. And so we have the framework for a system where money can transfer between deficit and surplus units. And rationally, there would be money, there's money to be made in providing those intermediary services to match up surplus and deficit units. It's not as simple as that. But interestingly enough, it is possible for you to be a surplus and a deficit unit at the same time, oddly enough. And you'll see why that could happen in just a little bit here. But the essential point that I'm making in this little beginning is that there is a framework for money to be made matching those who need money with those who have money. Now, here's where the complexity begins to occur in this. You see, there's different kinds of money. And we'll talk more about that on Tuesday, about the different types of money. And you'll hear me rage a little bit about some economic policies. But I'm going to bring up a term to you right now. Liquidity. Now, I caution you that the book beats around the bush a little bit about this, but I'm going to hit it right on the head. Liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Liquidity is the ease, the rapidity, the efficiency. The ease, the rapidity, the efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Look. That $5 bill I pulled out of my pocket there, where the hell did I put my money? Oh, there it is. I was going to say, I can convert this into a couple of cheeseburgers at Wendy's immediately. I can do it. Yes, I can. That means that this is a highly liquid asset. It's an asset, and it's highly liquid because I can convert it into something else, just like magic. Paper becomes cheeseburger. I can have cheeseburgers tonight. Speaking in lolcat language. But now look at you. You are an asset. Obviously. Handsome. Strapping. Sweaty. Rippling muscles. You could sell your body. You could, yes, indeed. I'm lying to you, noob, you can't. But look, here's the deal with it, though. There is value in you, in your mind, in your learning, in your productive ability. But that cannot be converted. You can't go to Steak and Shake or Snarf and Barf and say, I should like to trade my body, ripple, for a burger. It won't happen. You would have to go through a process of using the body and mind to create something that was more liquid, you see. So that the liquidity is not there, but it is still an asset. You could own a home, but at the same time, that's not going to buy you a meal. That's not going to buy you some clothes right away. It is a big, heavy-duty asset, but it is not a liquid asset. It is a highly illiquid asset. Now, this actually has teeth in it in the modern world, you see, because there was a time through the past 8 years when banks were accumulating enormous amounts of capital, but it was a highly illiquid form of money called M3. They couldn't do anything with it like pay a light bill, like pay their employees. So what did they do? They were essentially forced into a position where they had to use that heavy-duty asset as the backing to make quick money. Hence, we had the credit derivative swaps. They were backing fast-making bets with essentially highly illiquid money. Now, that takes a little of the edge off those evil financial institutions. The M3, it was the responsibility of our Federal Reserve to control that growth of M3. It was out of control. It was literally going at a rate that reached almost 20% growth rate annually, while the kind of liquid money that you and I and businesses use was not growing at all, hardly. The banks essentially were boxed into a position where in order to generate liquid cash, they had to use their heavy-duty assets to do it. Very similar to how if that home of yours, you really need money, you're going to go out and get a second mortgage and use it to put money in a checking account so that you can get food. It's the same thing that was happening. And it takes a little, but we can't say this in the popular media because all they want are sound bites and dumb statements to put out to people who love sound bites and dumb statements, hence the popularity of Fox News.
Excuse me.
But you see, it was a lot more complicated. Behind the scenes, there was this accumulation of great wealth, but it was illiquid wealth. And hence, you will see in a situation like that, this effort to try to get liquidity, squeeze a little bit of liquidity out of a highly liquid asset pile. But as a basic idea, liquidity, when I refer to liquidity, it refers to the ease, rapidity, efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Hence, M1 money, paper money, can be converted very quickly. Certain government securities like treasury bills, highly liquid assets, you can convert them very quickly. But then you go up the line to less liquid forms of money, like CDs. They're a CD, you know, there's a substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal. Well, yes, that means that it is not as liquid as you might like it for some purposes. So, in some sense, in a very real sense, you could be a deficit economic unit for liquid capital at the same time that you are a surplus economic unit in illiquid capital. Okay? So that's what I meant by that. You could be both at the same time. And in your case, you don't have any money in your pocket, do you? You do. Sweet. Why did I bother? Okay. But you see, some of these people in here, you obviously have value. There is money in you, but it is not liquid money. So if you needed money right now, immediately, you would be a deficit economic unit. At the same time, in a more illiquid sense, you're a surplus economic unit. You will provide value to firms. You will trade your asset for money and all that down the road. Look, I use the term securities. I slipped that one in here. Let me make a very broad shot at what a security is. I would get into this in all kinds of painful, gruesome details if you were to take me in a business law course. But it distills down to a relatively simple but subtle concept. A security is a representation of a claim on future cash flow. A security is a representation of a claim on future cash flow. A security is a representation of a claim on future cash flow. So when I talk about a security, I am talking about, it could be a document, a physical document. It could be an electronic document. But really, in reality, a security could be something that is nothing more than an oral contract. A security is a contract. Now, have you all had business law yet? I'm getting a lot of blank looks. Trust me, I'm not going to blow you away with business law. But a contract has four important parts: offer and acceptance, mutual consideration, legality, and capacity for the entering into the contract. Important for our purposes here is the mutual consideration. A security is a contract in the sense that something is being rendered for something. Something for something. That's what every contract has to have. It's not all a contract has to have, but it's a crucial part of a contract. Something of value for something of value. So when I issue a security, I am making a representation. I should like something now. And you are being conferred to you is a claim on something of mine later. That's essentially what a security is at its heart. It's an agreement that rises to the level of a contract, all those four parts, where I am providing you with something and you are going to provide me with something. We're making mutual promises, mutual representation. So, for example, well, let me do it this way. This is where a piece of terminology comes in that is going to be some, it might be odd to you at first, but it is crucial that you know this one. If you are a borrower, you are the issuer of a security. If you are the lender, you are the purchaser of the security. When you borrow money from a bank, you have decided that you are, it's time for you to become mature. You're going to buy a home. You put away your Barry Manilow albums. You put away your colorful underwear. And you decide that it's time to become mature. Okay? You put a little gray in the sides of your hair, and you get married. You have 3.2 children. Never knew that part of it. I driving by, and you see a typical average American family. There's a 0.2 kid looking at you. You're like, ah, God! You want to buy a home, but you're going to have to borrow money. Let's say you borrow $200,000, and you go to a bank, and the bank says, okay, we shall lend you that money. You are going to issue to the bank a promissory note with a mortgage attachment, but let's talk about the promissory note part of it, promising to repay them. You are the issuer of the security. You say, now, wait a minute, they had the papers. Actually, yes, they make the papers so that they're exactly to standards, but they give them to you, and it is fully within your power. Once you put your signature on it, you own that document, and you push it back to the bank. I issue hereby to the bank, and I'll be the bank here. And the bank agrees, I shall underwrite your security. I shall buy it from you. And in that way, what do I pay? The loan value, the face amount of the loan, under the terms and conditions of the promissory note and the attachment of the mortgage. So you understand that what has happened here is that I get a thing of value. Okay, this promissory note from you. And in exchange, you get a thing of value, the loan amount. You follow the idea? When you borrow, you are the issuer. When I lend, I am the buyer, the purchaser of the security. Sometimes you'll hear me use the term writer of the instrument. You are the writer, the issuer of the instrument. Even though the bank put the papers in front of you, those belong to you, and when you sign them, you are agreeing to transfer that security to me, the bank, and in exchange, you get money, thing of value for thing of value. Now, I have a security in my hand as the bank. That means that I can claim future cash flows from him, in this case, in the form of payments every month of a specific amount. I have a claim on your cash flow. And should you default on that, I have recourse under the terms and conditions of the promissory note and the mortgage attachment and the mortgage agreement. That's a hugely important idea because it, in a sense, it changes the way, subtly the way we think about how loans, how stock, and how all kinds of securities work. Because, in effect, you as the borrower have the power until you have made the actual sale of the instrument. Now, in the case of that bank loan, there was a prearrangement for the purchase. There always is when you do these, and like car loans too. Okay, so there was a prearrangement. We would call that an underwriting agreement. There was an underwriting agreement there. I was going to buy it. You wouldn't have done this without some certain knowledge that it was all going to come together there at that closing, on the loan closing, right? So there was an agreement there that there would be a purchase of the security. And that's what we call an underwriting in a slightly narrow context. Now, in this regard, I want to distinguish among types of securities. specifically types of debt securities, which is what I will focus on in the earlier part of this course. Later in the course, we'll get into stock, common stock, preferred stock. But for now, I'm going to focus on the debt side of securities. And I'm going to distinguish instruments in terms primarily of maturity. But this also has, as part of it, liquidity. There's a loose relationship. If I am talking about something that is a year or less, I call it a bill. If I am talking about something that is between 1 and maybe about 7 years, I will call it a note. If I am talking about something that is more than 7 years, and there is some fuzziness in here, I will be calling it a bond. Okay? Now, and forever I'm seeing textbooks that say a bill is less than a year. Well, I call it less than or equal to a year. A one-year treasury is a bill, in my judgment, but whatever. Look, you've used the term bill. I got a bill in the mail for quite a while. I'm sure you heard your parents use the term. You've heard people all over use the term. Interestingly enough, they used the term correctly, but they didn't know exactly why they were using it correctly. You see, let's say that you get a bill in the mail for your electric usage for the month. You see, obviously the electric company issued that bill to you, right? Wrong, electricity breath. You issued the bill. All the electric company did was send you a physical piece of paper representing the obligation, reminding you of your obligation. You see, by using the electricity, you are issuing a short-term obligation, and the electric company was accepting that short-term obligation that you owed to them. So as you use the electricity, you are issuing the bill. You are the issuer, not the electric company. When the electric company sends you that bill in the mail, they're sending you what belongs to you, you see. They're saying, this is yours. And in fact, you would say that. It's my bill. I don't say that. I say, that's the trash can's bill. But that is your bill. You issued the bill. And all the other side of it is reminding you is, yeah, we purchased your bill. We covered your electric usage, and now you got to pay us back. So, and why is it a bill? Because it's very short term. You have to pay that bill within a short period of time. So it's really a bill, short term. You are the issuer because you're the one who owes it. And you're the one who gladly agreed to turn on your lights. And now you're just getting the bill in the mail. It's yours. Yeah, they're just being kind enough to print it out and remind you to pay it. Let you know exactly how much it is. Kind of an open-ended bill. But that's what's going on there. This is a subtle kind of rethinking. Tightening up for the purposes of business people and the business thinking model. What is commonly used in terminology? Well, there's a bill. I got some bills in the mail. Now, the average person doesn't really understand. They issued those bills themselves. And all they're getting, that physical piece of paper, that's just a representation. It's not the actual obligation. The obligation was made when you used the electricity, when you used the water. That's when the obligation was made. That piece of paper is just a representation of it. And this is the way it is with all securities, is that there is this, the obligation is oftentimes separate from some piece of paper that you see. The obligation is oftentimes formed before there's a piece of paper. In a long time ago, I actually ran a penny stock house. And I worked with a company that actually issued stock certificates. This was in the time period when there was beginning to be a transition from physical pieces of paper to electronic stock. And the stock transfer agent, talked endlessly about these people who called up and they were just absolutely livid because they hadn't gotten their stock certificates in the mail. And he knew as well as I did, they owned the stock. The piece of paper wasn't the claim of ownership. It was merely a piece of paper showing, one way to show the claim of ownership of the corporation. But the ownership of the corporation was separate from that stupid piece of paper that they wanted so desperately to have. Now for notes. Notes are intermediate term obligations. They will come due in 1 to 7 years. Okay, now, some of you have actually issued notes. And I'm trying to think. Madam, have you ever issued a note? Not that I know of, you animal. No, have you?
I don't know.
You don't know? Do you own a car? Mm-hmm. Did you borrow for it?
Yes.
You issued a note. Why? How long is the term of the loan? God, I wish I had to ask that. It just bunches my boxers. Okay. Do you own a car? Do you have a loan on it?
Yeah.
Oh, damn it. What is it with you people? Okay. Someone in here has a loan. Yeah?
I do.
Okay, you have a loan. How long is it?
4 years.
4 years. You issued a debt instrument, was it a bank?
Yeah.
To a bank. The bank, in exchange for getting that instrument from you, gave you, actually they probably just gave the dealership, the money for the car. And now you have an obligation that must be completely fulfilled within 4 years under the terms of the loan. There you go. That's a classic note. In fact, a lot of the things that your intermediate assets are usually in that category. Cars are the classic consumer note. Cars are the classic consumer note. Now for the long ones, the long bombs. In consumer finance, the classic long bomb is the home mortgage, 20 to 30 year obligation. You follow with that? You will issue to a bank a promissory note. That note will have to be fulfilled completely in a period, if it's, let's say, a fixed rate 30 year, it will be fulfilled completely in 30 years. That classic note on the consumer side. Okay? These are the way we think in finance is we divide. Now, notice interestingly enough that there is a connection in terms of liquidity, the ease with which the asset can be converted. Bills generally will have high liquidity because the money is due very quickly. Notes, not as much liquidity. Mortgages, if I am a bank and I have a group of mortgages, in theory, and actually I would have taught this like 30 years ago when I was first teaching, I would have said, well, these mortgage obligations that the banks have are obviously highly illiquid. The bank can't convert that into cash right away. Well, of course, that's not the case now. As within minutes or hours or days, a bank has gotten rid of your mortgage. They simply buy the mortgage and then they immediately package it with a whole bunch of other mortgages that have come in a short period of time, and they sell those to a secondary mortgage market. So they are highly liquid now. The same is true of student loans. If any of you got a student loan at a bank, that bank got rid of that student loan within days. And it went in packaged with a bunch of other student loans and went up into a secondary market called Sallie Mae. So anymore, even though they're very long term, they're highly liquid, unlike in the old days when I first started teaching. So the connection between liquidity and the nomenclature is not as tight as it used to be, but it's still there to a large extent. Let me make a real quick comment here, another piece of terminology. Money that flows in this short-term market, we call the market for that a money market. If we're talking about money in this flowing in this heavier, longer-term framework, we tend to use the term capital market. Capital market. And so you'll oftentimes hear me say the capital markets this, the capital markets that. Well, I'm referring to these monstrous amounts of money that are flowing in these long-term movements between surplus and deficit economic units, and then back to the surplus units through the satisfaction of the obligations. But let me throw out just a couple of money market instruments that are common. Obviously, the consumer bills are a classic thing. Although we don't focus on consumer finance in this class, I like to bring them up because they connect you to what I'm talking about. But if I were to talk about money markets in general, money markets, one classic place, one classic instrument you see in the money market is government treasury bills. These are quick punches of borrowing the government does for different purposes. There was an auction of $16 billion in T-bills last week, something like that. Well, that would mean that the government is borrowing money, and it will pay this money back within a year, according to the terms of the T-bills that were issued. And I'm going to get back to those here in just a little bit, those T-bills. But that's a class, that would be a flow of money in a money market. There are others too. One that I would bring up are bankers' acceptances. And I'll tell you a little story about this. A banker's acceptance. When I got my degrees, and I went out there, and I decided I'm going to punch it out in the real world. I'm going to strike out on my own, mainly because no one was going to hire a sorry-ass-looking person like me. But I went into a penny stock house, and it got shut down in one day. Sons of bitches. But I longer term, I got into consulting, and one of the money-making ways in consulting was in doing brokering of assets, weird stuff. I mean, anything, everything from small amounts of diamonds to military goods to medical goods, I mean, adult tapes, anything you could broker between a buyer and a seller. It was just, it was kind of a greasy business and all of that. But one of the things that struck me was that as I was getting involved in this world, my business and economics training was wonderful, but it had these monstrous holes in it. No one had ever told me about. So I made this arrangement that there was going to be this purchase of this. There was a warehouse in Texas where there were a bunch of medical supplies. We're going to move them into Eastern Europe. And the guy on the other end of the phone said, well, we'll get the LOC together and move from there. You go ahead and do that part of it. And I hung up, and I said, okay. And I hung up the phone, and I thought to myself, what the hell is an LOC? Does anyone here, have you been taught what an LOC is? Or an SLOC or an SLC? It's a letter of credit. I'd never heard them. They'd never been taught to me. I'd had a bunch of finance courses. I'd never heard of one of these things. And it's completely common. Essentially, you get a bank to make the promise that they will pay for the supplies or whatever it is you're buying. These are as common as grass in international trade. You don't say, the buyer and the seller don't say, well, the buyer says, I'll pay you the money. No, the buyer has a bank issue a letter to me saying, we will pay you and then we'll take it, get it from the buyer. So that I have an assurance that I will get my money as the seller. I don't get my guarantee from you, the buyer. I get it from the bank that issues the letter of credit or the standby letter of credit, if that's how it works, on your behalf. That's a banker's acceptance. Who knew? I didn't know that's how it worked. Then I came to find out that's how it almost always works. Buyer and seller do not work out payment that's done through the banks, my bank and their bank, with letters of accept, with a banker's acceptance, accepting obligation for paying the bill on behalf of the buyer. And that's a very simplified way of talking about it. And as I found out, as I plunged in and started trying to learn that on the fly. But, okay, there's banker's acceptance. It's very short term because obviously the payments are made in within a matter of days or weeks. Okay. Now, here's another one that is very common out there. It's commercial paper. Now, commercial paper is issued by large, very credit-worthy corporations for short-term cash. So you might see, and I'm not saying this is one that would do it, but a Microsoft might need money for 20 days. They issue might need $10 million for 20 days. They'll issue commercial paper, and the surplus economic units, working through financial intermediaries, will simply buy that commercial paper, and therefore Microsoft will have its money, and it will pay it back within a very short period of time. That's the commercial paper market. Huge, huge market. And commercial paper is considered very safe because these are large credit-worthy corporations. Unfortunately, sometimes it ain't as safe as you think. Companies like Enron, shortly before they went Tap City, pumped commercial paper out, trying to save their asses in desperation. No one really knew, although a lot of people should have, that it was the companies were about to fall apart. But you know, when it's a large credit-worthy corporation, never had a problem before, issued commercial paper for years and years, of course, it's just going to be like automatic. Oh, we're issuing commercial paper, and oh, we got our money in the bank within a matter of hours. But it can be not quite as safe as maybe the textbook represents. Commercial paper in general is very safe. But, and it's highly liquid, but it's not highly liquid for you. You know why? Suppose, are you hungry right now? Yeah? You will be later tonight, okay? Yeah. And so will you. And you will too, okay? Okay, we're all going to go, just this row, we're all going to go to Wendy's, okay? Get some food. I got in my car a commercial paper. I got some commercial paper. We're gonna take that at the drive-thru? But I just said it's highly liquid. But it's not highly liquid for us, is it? So you guys are gonna have to pay for your own and mine. Okay? Sweet. They took that one. So those are some of the examples of highly liquid instruments that would flow in the money market. Now, in the capital market, that's the market where you get corporate and consumer notes and bonds. And again, this is not a consumer finance course, so I'll be focusing on the corporate side of it. And there are all manner of these, and I'll go through this a little later, naming the different kinds of instruments, the senior mortgage bonds, senior subordinated, junior, the difference between a debenture and a mortgage bond, and all that kind of stuff. I don't want to focus on that now. I'm looking for a broader arc here. But I do want to point out that there are terms that are going to endure in this course. Even into the last days of this course, these same things that I am telling you now, I will assume that you know them. For example, the term face or face value. In corporate finance, which is where we are, no more about consumer finance for a little bit. In corporate finance, unless I say otherwise, the face value of a bond is $1,000. In other words, on the date of maturity, the issuer of the bond must surrender $1,000. The face value, the principal amount. Every bond that I talk about, if I don't say something to the contrary, it has a face of $1,000. Notice, interestingly enough, and now I can't stand it. I got to go back to consumer finance. When we're talking about mortgages, the face isn't 1,000. The face is falling because you're amortizing the loan amount through the life of the loan. Okay? So, but setting that aside again. In corporate finance, when a bond is issued by a corporation, one thing is going to be for sure. On the maturity date of that bond, $1,000 must be surrendered. Okay? Now, the maturity date, that means when the obligation has been completed and the contract has been executed. In other words, the mutual considerations are all done. The maturity date is when it's all over. That's the end of the game. No more of it. Now, let me distinguish between two types of bonds and notes, and actually bills too. The common variety, the one that I will focus on most of the time, is the coupon bond. A coupon is a declaration of the percent of the face value that must be paid periodically in interest. A representation of the percentage of the face value that must be paid periodically, usually annually. So if I were to tell you that I had an 8.5 IBM 30, I own that bond. That means, first of all, that on the appropriate date in 2030, IBM has to send me a check for $1,000. You see, the $1,000 isn't there. You have to know that. That's just going to be an assumption. On the due date, on the maturity date in 2030, that's the 30, and I sometimes put that little tick mark there, although it's not going to, you're not going to see it probably in real quotes. IBM has to send me $1,000, okay? Now, along the way, this bond states, as part of the obligation of the issuer, IBM, and that's what the IBM is. The IBM is the issuer. That's what that says there, IBM. IBM issued it. So the bearer, in this case, moi, is going to get $85 every year. Is going to get $85 every year for this bond. In fact, in the real world, it won't be $85 every year. The payments would probably be rendered like $42.50 every 6 months, semi-annually. But for basic purposes right now, that says that the issuer, IBM, will provide the bearer on the appropriate date in 2030 with $1,000. And up to that 2030 and including that 2030 date, IBM will also be issuing, at least annually, an $85 check to the bearer of it. That's what that means. So when I toss that up there, that's what I'm talking about. However, there actually is another kind of debt instrument. It's called a discount instrument. Now, in the world of non-investment grade, that is a fancy way of saying junk, we use the term ZCB, zero coupon bond. I'm not going to get you into that right now. Let me focus on the classic example of a discount security. It's actually a T-bill, a one-year T-bill. Remember I said that the $1,000, there's no question about it, that goes. this statement right here, who issued it. That's definite. However, the coupon might not be there. In the case of a one-year treasury bill, there's no coupon paid by the government. You're saying, well, that's sucks.com. No, because you buy the instrument at a discount to par. In other words, at a discount to $1,000. Let me show you how it works, because there's a crucial, hugely important principle that is going on behind the scenes here. And I need another gir. Where the hell did I? Ah, there it is. I'm going to do one right here. Okay, now I'm going to put down here in serial columns, price, face, dollar interest, and then yield. Now I'm going to set up sort of a fanciful scenario to emphasize how this works, because there's a huge principle that's going to emerge from what I'm going to do here. Now, the way the Treasury raises money, it actually holds auctions. And in the old days, literally, it put physical paper with that face value on tables, and then buyers came, bought the securities, which was essentially that's lending the government money. And being the bearer of the certificate, the security, then the government owed that person the money back according to the terms of the security that was picked up and purchased off the table. Now, it's all electronic. Now, there's no auction table and all of that anymore. At least I don't think there is anymore. But the same principle applies. When the government needs to raise money, it usually uses a combination of bills, notes, and bonds or whatever. Sometimes you'll see the Treasury held a $12 billion auction of five-year notes, something like that. But let's try to focus on one where it is just Treasury bills. And we're going to go back to the old days where they're on the table, okay, and you have the Treasury bills salesman for the Treasury Department standing there waiting for customers to come in to buy these instruments, that is, to lend the government money. I'm looking around here at who I can use for this example. God, it's always hard to find someone good to pick on for a good example like this. Okay, we're just going to, for lack of more resources, we will just use you. Okay, now, you are a buyer. You come in and there's paper on the table, so you pick up one of these Treasury bills. Now, what's the face value of it? Come on. What is it?
$1,000.
Yes. Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Yes. $1,000. So you purchased this, okay? Now, you're not going to pay $1,000. Are you nuts? $1,000 so you can get $1,000 back in a year, you're going to pay less than $1,000 for it. You look around the room and you see that there's a lot of people looking at Treasury bills. So that's obviously the demand is strong. So that pushes the prices up, but it's certainly not going to be $1,000. At least we hope not. And so I am the salesman of them. So you're in the market for a Treasury bill. Well, we've got some nice ones here. Here you go. Slap that in your pocket there, big boy. And $975 sound okay? $975? Oh, of course it does. Slap. And so I give you your ticket to pay at the counter. Okay? Pay at the cash register. Now, you come up to the cash register, and I am the cashier. My name is Mabel. Oh, how are you doing there? Oh, my, you're a strapping young man. Yes, why did you? Yes, oh, let's see your ticket there. Oh, $975. So, $970. Now, let me get a bag for that. Earl, are there any bags in the back? Oh, we got a bag. There you go. There's your nice certificate and a bag. Now, you be a good boy and run along. And in a year, you'll get $1,000. Very nice. Okay. let's talk about what happened there. Okay. Aside from the fact that was very, very weird having me go into Mabel channeling. Okay. What was the price you paid? $975 was the price that you paid for that instrument. Now, what did you tell me the face value of it was?
$1,000.
It will always be $1,000. I don't care if the Lord God Himself tells you differently. If I don't, it is not different. Okay? I'll work out with the Lord later. Okay, now, dollar interest. In 1 year, you get a check for $1,000. How much dollar interest did you earn on the investment? Yes. That wasn't complicated. It was 25. You're looking like you're not sure if it's that simple. Yes, it is. Now here comes the payoff. We're going to calculate the yield. How much interest did he, what was the dollar interest?
25.
What was his investment amount? Don't ever put $1,000. I will try to bluff you on a multiple choice question by giving you the answer if you put $1,000 in the denominator. If you do, I will hunt you down like a dog and I will beat you with a rake. Okay. Yes. Now, what's 25 divided by 975? For God's sake, someone's got to have a calculator. What is it? 19. It is? My ass. It is? Yeah. Two. Give it. Okay. Rule. In this class, after you turn it into a percentage, it should be rounded to two decimal places. In this class, always, unless I say differently, always. You round to two decimal places after you have converted it to an interest rate. So that's four decimal places as a decimal. So what would it be? 2.56%, right? Okay, always. Don't give me something where you've written out 20,000 decimal. Well, my calculator does lots of decimal places. Don't do that. And don't round it too short either, because then you won't see subtle differences that are important for us. Okay, so we've got 2.56%. That's the yield. Now let's go to the second round. That worked out pretty well for you. You got $25. That was enough for Denny's, for you and your lady friend.
Nice.
Yes. You will not sleep alone tonight. Okay? Now, so you figure this works. So you're going to come back to the next treasury auction. And here I am, the treasury guy. Ha, ha, ha. You want to buy some treasury bill again? And you walk up to the table, and then you stop and you look around. Wait a minute. There aren't a whole lot of people here this time. There were more last time. There aren't as many here. So, well, are you going to pay $9.75 again? You say, kiss my ass. No. Well, gee, I can't get to the table because there are so many people here buying. No, there aren't. No one's buying. So that means that I can pay less. Oh, right. So we agree to $9.50 on this round. Mabel, you go up to Mabel. Well, there you are again. My goodness, you are. Yeah, you're coming back for another round. You're going to be a regular customer, and let's see your ticket here, $9.50. Oh, my, that's a good buy. Yes, for one of these quality instruments. Earl Moore bags! We put it in a nice plastic bag. You have a good day now. You'll get your $1,000 in the mail in a year. Good boy. Price this time? Come on. Price. $9.50. What's the face? $1,000. Talk to me. What's the interest, dollar interest this time? $50. You paid $9.50. You got $1,000 back, so your dollar interest is $50. OK? Okay, so now let's calculate the yield again. This time, what did you say the dollar interest was? 50. What was the dollar? What was the investment price? 950. Again, don't, for God's sake, don't put 1,000 there. That's the temptation. It is the price, what you invested in money. Okay, now, what's 50 divided by 950? Well, I'll be. And there is a shining example of one of the most important first principles in finance. The price of a security is inversely related to its yield. As price goes down, you see the price went down and the yield goes up. If the price goes up, the yield goes down. Price and yield are inversely related. Always and forever. It's not a theory, it's just a mathematical fact. So, as you see, you can look at the financial papers. The price of treasuries at the auction collapsed. What does that mean is happening to the yields on those securities? It's increasing, which means eventually what will happen to interest rates across the economy? If the government's going to pay more for money, that means your ass is too. So that's why it matters to know this. As you watch, what is happening in the government auctions? Are the buyers of these, the lenders, flocking to the auctions? If they're not, that could mean trouble. And that's exactly what's happening. The Federal Reserve has been trying to keep yields so low that literally the prices have been floating at 1,000 in some cases. There are actually auctions where the price was going off at above $1,000. I said that couldn't happen. Yeah, it has. In other words, negative yields, that's the weirdest thing in the world, but it's happened. But now, the pressure is just getting way too much. The Fed can't hold the line on low interest rates. The government's holding auctions, and the buyers are just not showing up. And so that means the prices of treasuries are sliding downward, and that's creating higher yields on the treasury instruments, and ultimately that's going to articulate through the entire economy. And no matter what the Fed does to try to hold interest rates down, very soon, interest rates are going to start rising. And as interest rates rise, that threatens the stability of the economic recovery. I've written a couple of articles, one at Examiner, for the Examiner, in which I was explaining this relationship. So there is some concern now. How long can we hold off before interest rates go up? The longer we can hold it off, the more this recovery can get its own legs and get steam. Unfortunately, I still think that we're going to have a decent recovery, but as a bad, bad payoff, we're going to get hit with inflation very, very bad soon. Let me take this on now. You remember this for the rest of your life, okay? I mean that, okay? In 30 years, I'm going to be staggering down a street. I'm going to see you. I'm going to grab you. Yeah. What's the relationship between yields and price on debt securities? Oh, I love it when you talk like that. I'm maybe old. Yeah. God, you always did make me happy. Oh, wait a minute. One of my tubes is coming out here. Could you hook that back up? I feel something leaking. Good man. Yeah. See, in 30 years, your daughter will be in my class. And she will hear the same thing, because this principle never changes. It will be the same now and forever. This is one of those classic, no argument principles. It's huge too. And let me give you, practically speaking, you probably even know this inside. Okay, you're going to pay me back $10,000 in 20 years. Which you want me to lend you, $8,000 or $2,000 now? For that?
8,000.
You think? Yeah, obviously. See, because the more you get for the price, you want a higher price for issuing that, because you're going to have to pay me back $10,000
in 20 years, I said. So clearly, the higher the price, the less you're paying in interest. Yeah, the principle is all over the place. It's just sort of a classic principle. Okay? And this is one of two hugely rock-solid important principles of finance. The other one comes soon enough, having to do with risk and expected return. But this one's very cool to get out in the first couple of classes. Now, let me bring up financial intermediaries just for a few minutes here. I sneaked in a term, the term underwriting. Now, in the world where buyers and sellers of securities interact, there are different institutions to satisfy different market constituencies. Like, for example, for consumer loans, that would be a typical traditional bank would be a classic place. Also for small businesses, a traditional bank would be for your working capital loans, for your loans for cars and loans for homes. But now there are other places for other kinds of capital. For example, if a large company wanted to raise money by issuing a group of bonds, issuing bonds, they would do it through an investment banker. And the investment banker would essentially be the intermediary between this company that needs money and the institutions and individuals that have money. Now, there are two essential ways that an offering can go off. One is by a firm underwriting, and that would be where we have something like an IBM, let's say. And basically, the investment banker says, we'll buy your bonds, and then we'll sell them for ourselves on our own account. That would be a firm underwriting. That's very much the way car loans and home loans work for most people. There's a pre-arrangement. There's not some search, mad search right at the issue date. However, there's also another kind. This was the world I was in as a broker, a rainmaker for little companies that were just getting started. This is called a best efforts offering, where the underwriter says, we're not going to buy this from you. We'll try to sell it on your behalf, but we're not going to buy it from you. There's no guarantee. Okay? So there are these two different kinds. There's the firm underwriting, which is almost always the way it works with big companies. And then there's the best efforts, which is the world where there's some group that tries to sell it for you. Now, although the book doesn't bring this up, I'll just mention it very quickly here. Usually, let's say we're doing a firm underwriting. And the lead underwriter is, well, back in the old days, let's say the lead underwriter was Goldman Sachs. Now, what Goldman Sachs would do is it would not buy the whole offering itself. It would create what's called a syndicate, a group of underwriters that it would be the lead underwriter. And then it would say, all right, you, 10%, you're going to buy investment banker over here. Investment banker over here, you'll buy 5%. And that way, we spread the risk out. We buy it from IBM, but then we, as the syndicate, sell it out from our account. IBM has a certainty that it's gotten its money. And then the risk of getting the sale, of selling, unloading that stuff, falls to the investment banking syndicate that entered into this underwriting agreement with the company. I'm not emphasizing that. I just want to tell you that's more realistically how it works. Now, even in best efforts, what we used to call Western-style offerings, I'd set up syndicates. I'd get a bunch of small penny stock houses together, and I'd say, all right, we need to sell these securities. I know you're not going to buy them for your own account from this company, but I want to set up a syndicate so you all these different little brokerage houses will try to sell the securities to raise money for this company. But now let me get on to another one of those places where I have to distinguish between common language and what we mean in finance and in business law. Now, even the book here kind of sidesteps it. It mentions it, but then it kind of jumps all across it. I want to hit it right on the head here. is the difference between a broker and an agent. The difference between a broker and an agent. A broker represents the buyer. An agent represents the seller. And if you don't think that distinction matters, look at a sign of someone who is going to pose to help you with something, like insurance. Let's do an insurance. I am going to buy my insurance from Al's Insurance Agency. Al's Insurance Agency. Whom does Al represent? You? As you're going to go to Al's. I'm Al. Big Al. Yeah, we'll get you some insurance there. Slap you on the back. Yeah, I'm Big Al. It's Al's Insurance Agency. Am I going to represent you? If not, whom am I representing?
You represent me.
The agent represents what? The seller. Okay. Are you selling an insurance policy? You're buying. I don't represent you. I don't represent anything about you. I don't represent you, your head, your ass, nothing. I represent the insurance companies. They're the sellers of the products, the insurance products. I don't represent you at all. I represent the insurance companies because I am an agent. It says on my sign, agency. That means that I represent the sellers of insurance products, insurance packages. I'll put something together from them for you, but I represent them. A real estate agent. You want to buy a house, and you call a real estate agent. Whom does that real estate agent represent? You? Oh, it represents, the agent represents the sellers of the house, the sellers of different houses. Doesn't represent you. You say, well, you're saying, well, wait a minute, a broker, where does the broker fit in? Well, actually, in the world of insurance, huge companies don't go to insurance agencies. They go to what are called insurance brokers. In the old days, we called them the alphabet houses. M&M, Marsh & Mack, J&H, Johnson & Higgins, A&A, Alexander & Alexander. These were companies that actually represented huge firms and took those firms' needs and negotiated on behalf of the firms with the big insurance companies, like the Cincinnati and the Zurichs and the AIGs. You don't get that kind of treatment, but that is where the big money was made, because in that those kinds of companies, you had these, the top tier was called the producers. They were nothing but glorified salesmen. They were the ones who got companies to agree to have the alphabet house represent them. And then the account executives were below the producers. They were the ones who set up the mechanics of all the things that were needed to get a good insurance package for a company together. And then they worked with insurance companies to get the best price. But they were representing the buyers, the companies that needed insurance. You ain't going to get that. Well, we're on your side. You remember that insurance company Nationwide is on your side? Bullshit! It's an agency. Now, some agencies actually have a brokering wing. You aren't going to get in that brokering wing unless you're really powerful, okay, or you're a company. That's just the reality of it. A broker represents the buyer. An agent represents the seller. Now, that really, you know, we use the term agent all the time. And we use that whether it's a broker or an agent. But when you are doing something that matters, know the difference. And if you see that you're going to be a buyer and you're going to go to an agent, understand that the agent will not represent your ass. It will not. By virtue of the legal structure of the terminology. Now, state law requires that they don't screw you. But at the same time, there is no law that says that they have to bend over backwards for you if they're an agent. Now, brokers, so for example, if you're buying stock, you would probably go through a brokerage house, which means that you would actually have people representing you as the buyer of stock. You would actually, a broker actually is representing you. So when you say, you call your broker on the phone, I would like 100 shares of Microsoft, that broker has as his or her legal obligation and fiduciary duty to get you the best price based upon your conditions, limits, all that kind of stuff, price limits and all that kind of stuff. There, that broker is on your side because that's the broker's job, is to be on your side. So that gives you a place where you would see the your interest as a buyer being represented. Okay, so here we go. Here's another term, dealer. And here again is a term that is used all the time, dealer. But in our world, it has very specific meaning. A dealer represents himself or herself. Doesn't represent a buyer, doesn't represent a seller. A dealer represents himself or herself. So you see, in going back to stock markets, the broker would take your order and try to execute it at the best price representing you. But the broker will go to the floor and on some exchanges, the broker will go to the floor and the floor is populated with islands of dealers. The dealers are there. They buy stock and sell stock for themselves. So as if I am your broker, I run to the floor. I've gotten the order. I've run to the floor to make to put the order in. I will go up and I will look at the dealer who's making a market in Microsoft. And this is not the right example, but it'll do. And I'll look at what the dealer is doing. I don't know what Microsoft is selling at. I can't stand to look at Bill Gates making money. But let's say it's selling at, it was around, you gave me an order. I want to buy it at $90 a share. Okay? So I go up to the dealer and I see that the dealer is offering to sell at 96. Now I see that the bid is 86. The offer is at 96. So what I'm going to do with that dealer is I'm going to say $90. He says, no, 96, right up there, I have $90. And the son of a bitch beside me screaming says 92. So he's got me beat. I can't fill your order as long as someone's trying to beat me. Okay, wait a minute. I can go over here. I got 50 shares. 50 shares, I can fill 50 shares at 90. Then I got to go somewhere else. I go back up to that dealer, and there he is. Okay, he's dropped down to 92. He made that bid. It looks like it's soft on the market. Step back for a minute. And then I say 90, and he'll say sell. Good. But he's working for himself, you see. He's a dealer. Just like a car dealer. The car dealer buys cars and then sells them for his own account. That's a dealer. And any time you see you're working in any kind of an environment, if you see a dealer, a car dealer, a furniture dealer, they are working for their own account. They buy at low, at a bid, and they sell higher at an ask or an offer price, okay? Now, here's a trick. You got to write this down. We're almost out of time here, okay? Here, you buy low, you sell high. Write it down, for God's sake. Really? I mean, real finance for real people. Am I giving you value in this course or what? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.